And joining us on the phone now is Professor Catherine Pearson. She is an associate professor at the University of Minnesota Department of Political Science. Professor Pearson, thanks so much for taking time to be with us on the Roadhouse.
My pleasure.
My guess is that given the recent events that you and your colleagues in the Department of Political Science at the U are in pretty good demand on the interview circuit right now.
I think that's right. There's a lot going on in politics.
I'm not the brightest bulb on the tree or the sharpest knife in the drawer. Can you, in 25 words or less, explain how we're in a federal government shutdown? How did we get here?
25 words or less. I've just used some of them, but
you can
basically, every year, Congress is charged with passing 12 annual appropriations bills that fund the federal government and therefore federal employees by October 1st. And the House and the Senate have to pass the same version, and then the President must sign them into law. And well before October 1st and the debate over the continuing resolution, or the CR, it became clear that Congress was not doing its job, because not one single one of those 12 annual appropriations bills had been passed by both chambers and signed into law by the President. And so what we're talking about here is a continuing resolution to keep the government funded at last year's levels. And those levels are the sequester levels. They include the cuts negotiated a couple years back by Congress. But even the Senate and the House and the President can't agree on this stopgap measure or this continuing resolution to keep the government funded, because Republicans want to include policy provisions that either defund or delay or somehow sort of gut the core of Obamacare.
Which is the Affordable Care Act.
Right.
If I'm not mistaken, the last federal government shutdown of this nature happened 17 years ago. Is that correct?
Correct. In 1995 and 1996. And together, the shutdowns lasted 26 days.
And what was the dispute then?
The dispute then was over funding levels, specifically for Medicare and other domestic spending.
Okay.
And so it wasn't so much what the policy looked like or policy provisions as we're debating today, but it was about spending levels.
Well, you mentioned 12 appropriation bills that need to be passed. Can you give us just kind of an idea of what those are? I understand that they're to fund the federal government, but what kind of bills are we talking about?
Sure. So these are 12 distinct bills that fund different agencies. So one of the bills, for example, funds the legislative branch. It does not include Member of Congress pay. That's been the subject of a lot of debate, but it does include the legislative staffers and legislative branch operations. Another one of these bills funds the Department of Defense. Another bill funds the Department of Housing and many other related agencies. The Department of Commerce is, of course, in one of these bills. So
mm-hmm.
all federal agencies are included in one of these bills, and then the federal employees that work at these agencies and the programs that they oversee.
Now, if I understand correctly, some 800,000, give or take, federal employees are now, quote-unquote, furloughed.
That's right.
On
that means they're not permitted to come to work.
Right. And as a result, obviously, a lot of federal agencies, federal parks, what have you, are closed. They're deemed, if I'm not mistaken, the word is essential, non-essential employees. How many, to the best of your knowledge, how many, obviously, the Congress did not deem themselves non-essential, but how many of their staffers, how many people that work in the legislative branch were furloughed? Any?
You know, I don't have a number, but the vast majority of legislative staffers are deemed essential.
So they're still at work.
So some legislative staffers are deemed non-essential and not working, but for the most part, it's my understanding that legislators have deemed the majority of their staffs essential. That's what happened in 1995, but early on into the 1995-1996 shutdown, the Congress did pass its legislative appropriations bill.
Oh, I see.
But that has not happened this time around.
That brings up a good question, and I want to remind our listeners that we're visiting with Professor Catherine Pearson, who is an associate professor at the University of Minnesota in the Department of Political Science. Could they pass, for instance, could they decide to pass one or two of the appropriations bills and those employees could go back to work, or do they deal with all of them at the same time?
They absolutely could pass any number of the appropriations bills. And in fact, we're looking at a similar strategy to that by House Republicans right now. So House Republicans are bringing up bills that would bring back certain federal employees. They're not bringing up specific appropriations bills. So, for example, they wouldn't include all of the federal employees that work in certain agencies, but they are bringing up bills that would put back to work the federal employees that say govern the services that are most visible to constituents who are seeing the effects of the federal shutdown.
And I want to talk about those constituents in just a sec, but and I may have read this, but I'm not sure that I did. We got people in the Army. Those are federal employees.
Right.
What happens with soldiers who are stationed in Afghanistan?
Well, military pay, actually, the night right before the shutdown started on September 30th, Congress passed and the president signed into law a bill that would ensure that military personnel are, in fact, not furloughed and being paid.
Okay.
But that doesn't mean that civilians who work at the Department of Defense are being paid. And so we do have a lot of Department of Defense employees who are not working because they're furloughed, but military personnel themselves are working and are being paid.
Sure. For a number of years, Congress, both members of both House and the Senate, have held incredibly low have scored incredibly low in opinion polls. Almost universally, people in America do not think they're doing their job. A situation like this, where literally in many areas the federal government comes to a grinding halt, can't help that opinion at all.
That's right. I've seen public approval of Congress as low as 10% in the last few days. And that is understandable. Public opinion of Congress is always lower than that of the Supreme Court or the president because individuals tend to see sort of the messiness of lawmaking. They see the conflict. They see the compromise. And Americans really don't like to see either of those things, although I think a lot of Americans would like to see some compromise right now.
Exactly.
And so Congress is always the lowest branch, but the approval is particularly low right now, and that's completely understandable. One has to wonder who are the 10% of Americans who approve of the job that Congress is doing.
Yeah, probably, perhaps non-furloughed staffers. Well, given that, you know, if you go back through history, I don't know that Congress has ever held a real high. I mean, even going way back, Congress has always taken a lot of shots. But it seems to me over the past few years, people have complained more than I can remember about the bitter partisanship that exists. It just seems like nothing can get done. You mentioned compromise and going back over the days of Hubert Humphrey and Everett Dirksen and some of them, it seemed there'd be way more compromise. Is that true, or do we just forget about the fact that they were as partisan as today's Congress is?
Well, we are seeing record levels of partisan polarization. And partisan polarization doesn't have to accompany gridlock, but in this particular case, it has, because the parties are far apart on policy, and then they're also showing an unwillingness to compromise. And some of that is for strategic reasons, and some is for sort of partisan reasons, and some is because there seems to be a lack of leadership. But what it means is not only do we have a government shutdown because Congress hasn't passed any of its 12 annual appropriations bills, we also have the Farm Bill, for example, which is routinely passed with bipartisan support, mired down in partisan politics this year. That's happened to transportation bills. So even in areas where we typically do see bipartisan cooperation, we're not seeing that. And so it's the combination of partisan polarization and I think just a real lack of leadership in terms of Congress fulfilling its most basic responsibilities.
And I want to talk about that as far as the leadership goes. Obviously, one of the big contentions with this impasse is the fact that Republican members of the House have pretty well said that to pass these, it needs to be a defunding or at least a cutback on the Affordable Care Act. And first of all, I'm wondering if that kind of have we seen that kind of strategy before, where we're trying to dismantle, it would appear, dismantle something that's maybe new but already in place in order to get some other stuff passed.
The scope of the policy, sort of the policy debate surrounding the appropriations process is unprecedented. There are typically minor policy provisions added to so-called must-pass legislation, like continuing resolutions or appropriations bills. So we've certainly seen policy provisions added before. So, for example, President Clinton signed into law some policy provisions he may have disagreed with because they were attached to spending bills, but never of the scope of what we're seeing right now, where an entire major law is the attempt to dismantle an entire law of such historic proportion, that has not been attempted before. And certainly the reason that it's being attempted on this must-pass legislation is to force the president's hand. But what we have here is a real policy battle over the budgeting process, which is, according to House and Senate rules, supposed to be devoid of the policymaking process. So even in the past, when much smaller policy provisions have been added to the appropriations bills to force the president's hand, it's actually been a violation of House or Senate rules.
As it is in this case.
Correct.
It's unlikely, or it appears unlikely, that President Obama is going to give certainly very much. I mean, in many ways, the Affordable Care Act was kind of his signature piece of legislation, the one thing that he said he was going to do that he truly has. And certain Republicans seem just as intent on not letting the thing go through as it passed. What does this portend then for a length? And I realize this is a difficult question to answer, but what do you think it would portend for the potential length of this shutdown?
Two things. I don't think the shutdown will end anytime soon because both sides appear to be dug in. The president has said he is not going to sign anything other than a so-called clean continuing resolution into law, a continuing resolution that certainly does not attack the core of Obamacare. And then the second issue is this is also becoming wrapped up in the debt ceiling. The debt ceiling is the next fiscal crisis that the U.S. is facing, where the debt limit must be raised to avoid the U.S. defaulting on its obligations. And because both of these things are coming up, I suspect some sort of compromise will deal with both of these issues, and the debt ceiling issue is, you know, that will take until at least October 17th to resolve, because that's when the Treasury Department has said that the U.S. will initially come up against this debt limit. And so I think these things have become wrapped together. And the president is in a much stronger position than he was the last time we came near a default in 2011, because, of course, he's won re-election and given the voters a chance to speak on Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act. Now, of course, there are many reasons for individuals' vote, and so it's not to say that everyone who was voting for or against the president was doing so on the basis of the Affordable Care Act, but certainly now that he has won re-election, he's in a much stronger position than he was in 2011.
Right. I want to remind our listeners we're visiting with Professor Catherine Pearson, an associate professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Minnesota down in the Twin Cities. I read a quote today, which to me seems, and I'm not landing on one side or the other, but it seems indicative of the frustration that people may feel about this. A Republican representative from Indiana made the quote that we're not going to be disrespected. I think he meant the Republican Party. We have to get something out of this. And I don't know what that even is. How can we be negotiating or even giving the impression of negotiating when at least one side, maybe the other two, doesn't even know what they're negotiating for?
Well, that is the interesting. There's an interesting dynamic in this debate. And that is, if you're just looking at the spending levels in the continuing resolution that the Democratic-led Senate passed with solely Democratic votes, the spending levels are the spending levels that Republicans wanted. These spending levels include the sequester cuts from last year.
Yep.
And so Republicans you can imagine a scenario where Republicans could have declared victory and said the spending levels are below what Democrats wanted, the sequester cuts are locked in, and let's declare victory. But that, of course, is not what happened, and we're in a situation now where the Republican Speaker of the House, John Boehner, is insisting on cuts to Obamacare, and Democrats are saying absolutely not. And so it is hard to imagine how we come out of this with both sides dug in. That said, many House Republicans, and by many I mean, you know, 19 or 20, certainly not a majority, but enough House Republicans have said that they would vote for a clean continuing resolution if it were on the House floor, that it seems to me that if you include all Democrats and the Republicans who have indicated they would vote for a clean CR, that it would be possible for the House to pass a clean CR. But because Speaker Boehner has very tight agenda control over the House floor in his position as Republican Speaker, he's not going to bring up a bill that's a clean CR because it would anger the majority of his conference, especially the most conservative Tea Party members. So, you know, John Boehner's in a quite a difficult position on the one hand, but he also does seem to be held captive by his most conservative members rather than his most moderate members.
And this is a position that Boehner has found himself in really almost on a continuing basis. You talked about lack of leadership, and a lot of people have certainly leveled that charge at Boehner in terms of either he's not kowtowing to the more conservative, or he's cowing too much to the conservative. Do you think that there's enough? I heard you say that if it could get to the floor, you think there's enough Republicans that would vote for a clean continuing resolution so that they possibly could get the government up and running again?
Based on the tallies calculated by the Washington Post of the Republicans who've indicated that they would vote for a clean CR if they had the opportunity, if you take those members and all Democrats, and that's an assumption there about Democrats,
sure.
Many would have to hold their nose because they don't like the spending cuts. But it seems that passage in the House certainly would be possible, but I don't see Speaker Boehner bringing a clean CR to the House floor. As of now, he's saying he will refuse to bring anything that doesn't really attack the core of Obamacare, although who knows? I mean, maybe he'd be willing to bring something that involved a different type of concession, but that's certainly not anything he's indicated so far.
I have heard from a number of people of congressmen who are opposed to it. They keep bringing up the fact that the Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, this unconstitutional bill. What, unless I'm really badly mistaken, and please correct me if I'm wrong, this is a bill that was passed by Congress, it was signed by the president, and then was gave an opinion on by the Supreme Court, all of which declared that the bill is constitutional. How now can they use the argument that it's unconstitutional?
Well, it's a rhetorical argument, but it's not an argument that squares with the reality of the ruling by the Supreme Court.
Yeah, yeah. One last question, and again, thank you so much for being with us, but you are currently working on a book, if I'm not mistaken, entitled Party Discipline in the House of Representatives. I'm sure some people have suggested a different title, party discipline or lack thereof. Can you tell me how does all of this play into what you're working on with your book?
Well, it does, and it actually has created some complications because previous Republican speakers, such as Newt Gingrich and Dennis Hastert, have been able to really keep their more moderate members in line, really getting them to vote with the party even when they didn't want to, because party leaders control so many resources important to members of Congress, their committee assignments, what bills will come to the floor. But what we're seeing now is instead of defections from more moderate members, we're seeing that the most conservative members are at times the least cooperative with the speaker. And so that's causing Speaker Boehner a lot of headaches, and it's also making him a much less effective speaker than, say, his predecessors, Hastert and Gingrich were.
Yeah. I would love to keep talking with you, but unfortunately we do have constraints of time. We have been visiting with Professor Catherine Pearson, an associate professor of political science at the University of Minnesota, And Professor Pearson, I want to thank you very, very much for taking time to be with us. I'm sure this must be a very busy but interesting time for folks in your line of work.
Indeed, indeed. I'm happy to chat with you.